Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Laughter has been called the best medicine, even though there isn't significant science research to back up the claim. Few would argue they feel worse after a good laugh. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein know the value of humor. They're the duo behind the popular Plato and a Platypus Walk Into a Bar, a book that found the philosophical underpinnings of jokes. Their latest endeavor is another spin on philosophy and humor. It's titled I Think, Therefore I Draw, Understanding Philosophy Through Cartoons. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein Jonas join us from the studios of WAMC. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mindy. It's so good to be back.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Now you two,
I feel like I'm in the Cape already.
You two studied philosophy together at Harvard 60 years ago, and I'm sure you're well aware that students of philosophy are the butt of many jokes, such as this one. A graduate with an engineering degree asks, how does it work? A graduate with a science degree asks, why does it work? A graduate with an accounting degree asks, how much will it cost? A graduate with a philosophy degree asks, would you like fries and a Coke with that?
Yes.
And just one more.
Unfortunately,
I got
we've
one,
heard that.
One more.
Yes.
What's the difference between a philosophy major and a large pizza?
Ooh.
I like the setup.
The pizza can feed a family of four.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So why?
You know what, you sound like my father.
So why is philosophy the butt of so many jokes?
For that reason, I think. Everybody's father worries that they're not going to be able to make a living afterwards, and some of them aren't able to make a very good living afterwards.
Yeah. It's not a very practical thing unless you become a teacher. Yeah. Although, I must say, in our class, there was this one guy who we had in a tutorial, a classmate, and he was very quiet, and he thought it would be good to preparation for law. And then he became a member of the Supreme Court.
Wow.
David Souter. So I guess, and I tried to read some of his opinions, and I saw they had a certain philosophical bent to them, you know? And so I think it's useful in some ways. Neither Tom nor I were asked to be on the Supreme Court, however.
Speak for yourself.
So do you think comedy's inherently related to philosophy?
In a weird way, I think it is. You know, as Danny said in Plato and a Platypus, they have something in common, and that is they sort of lead you down one path, and then they pull the rug out from under you, you know, with a joke. That's the punchline. But with philosophy, it's they try to sneak something new into your brain by leading you down the sort of ordinary path. And they say, well, wait a minute, do you really know that this is a table or whatever?
Yes.
Sort of kind of answering my next question in a way, you're both known for writing and telling jokes. So how is the humor in a cartoon different from a joke?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Yeah, it
Mindy.
Is a good one.
It's certainly more to the point. And particularly New Yorker cartoons, because often you have to look a second time at the New Yorker. You read the caption and then you have to go back and look at it. But it's punchier. It's not the narrative, you know. It's sort of an implied narrative. You sort of make up the story by looking at the picture, which is its own kind of fun. But it doesn't have, you know, the drawn out narrative quality, of course, that the joke does. What would you think, Danny?
Yeah, I think sometimes cartoons are sort of subtler. And one of the reasons we wrote this book is because Plato and a Platypus continues to be read and copies to be sold to young people and young people in 30 different languages. And they will sometimes write to us. That's one of the beauties of the Internet age. You know, you hear from your readers very directly. And they would say, your book is great, but there's nothing about Sappho or nothing about Derek Parfit or, various other philosophers who they're interested in and who have been reading. And so we said, yeah, well, that's true, but we can't find jokes because these are sometimes very subtle philosophers, a lot of them are just very subtle. And then we said, whoa, just a minute. Cartoons speak to some of the philosophers that just ordinary jokes do not. And then, wow, we had an idea for a new book.
I was going to say, wouldn't you think that cartoons are a little more thought-provoking sometimes than a joke?
Yes,
you're saying
that's
subtle,
for sure.
But thought-provoking, right?
Thought-provoking is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they have levels. Like one of my favorite cartoons in our new book is a picture of Santa Claus sitting in a chair, and he's reading a book called How to Believe in Yourself.
That's funny.
But it just strikes me, I don't know whether it strikes other people this way, is having so many levels, you know. I mean, how is Santa Claus going to believe in himself as this guy who is, you know, who's all over the world one night with the help of a few reindeer and elves? I don't know. It's just there's so many levels to it. And then when Tom and I talked about it, we thought it was a good opportunity to talk about Kierkegaard and his idea of leap of faith, that belief is a leap of faith. Yeah,
that's probably what you thought, too. Yeah, everybody does.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the New Yorker magazine, which is known for its cartoons. And within the last decade, they started a weekly cartoon contest. So the magazine supplies a cartoon without a caption.
Which my daughter won one time.
Oh, is that right? And then, readers submit captions, which are voted on and then awarded. I know you said your daughter has done it. Have either of you tried up with coming with those captions?
Yes.
For these, it's not easy.
Yes, I won
very
one time
hard.
Too.
You did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Two in one family.
Yeah.
What
amazing.
Are the odds, right?
Yeah.
I, on the other hand, draw a complete blank. I want to so badly to submit a caption. Actually, I did submit one, and it didn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. But usually, I just go blank.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's what happens to me too. So, do you have favorite cartoonists, and are they some that tend to draw more philosophical cartoons?
Yeah. There's a guy who just died actually a couple of years ago called Leo Kullum. And the characters in his cartoons are often dogs, but he has the subtlest sense of humor. And the most beautiful drawing style. That's one of the great things about the New Yorker cartoons is they're so well drawn. You know, they're so whimsical, and they're each cartoonist has a slightly different style. We just love them.
Yeah. There was another one. We, in the course of writing the book, of course, we had to go through thousands, literally thousands of cartoons, not just New Yorker, Punch, the British magazine. And believe it or not, the old Saturday Evening Post had some really wild ideas. You know, I always thought of it as just this family magazine that would have very innocent cartoons. But when you look at some of those from the 50s, they were ahead of their time. I mean, there's one we have in there from the Saturday Evening Post about some older women sitting around talking about the intricacies of football. I've forgotten the exact caption.
And yeah. She's saying something like, no, Mavis, I think you're wrong. I think a tight end, if he lines up as a tight end, can be something or other. I forgot exactly the football terminology. But, yeah, she's an expert, obviously, on the NFL.
Mm. Yeah, and so, you know, they were ahead of their time in terms of, you know, gender philosophy.
Sure. So what can a cartoon tell us about philosophy and philosophy about cartoons?
Ooh.
Deep questions here today.
Deep.
Yeah.
Deep.
Tom usually does deep, but I'll try. I think cartoons, we'll take the one, what can cartoons do for philosophy, is they can set the train of philosophical thought going. You know, like that one I mentioned of Santa Claus reading How to Believe in Yourself. It draws you into this idea is, what is it to believe in yourself, and what is it to have an irrational belief, and how do you get there? Well, those are philosophical questions, but it's summed up in this really, I think, bizarre and wonderful cartoon. What philosophy tells us about cartoons? I'm going to throw that one back to you, Tom.
Oh dear. Well, one thing we discovered about some of these cartoonists is that they really, you know, our conceit in the book is that these guys are all PhDs in philosophy that, you know, didn't like drawing lattes for the rest of their lives and so started doodling on the margins of their books and turned out to be a cartoonist. But I think some of them, that's kind of true. I think some of them sort of started with a philosophical bent and then saw a way to put it on the page and to draw it in a funny way. And so I think, you know, sometimes you can back into a cartoon by being, first of all, a kind of amateur philosopher.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you mentioned you had to look at a lot of cartoons as you were putting this book together. So what were some of your favorite places to find philosophical cartoons?
Well, there are on the net now certain what they call cartoon banks, I guess. The New Yorker has one. There are a whole bunch of them. It's for people who want to use cartoons, you know, for advertising or to reprint somewhere. And, you know, and you just go through them one by one. And we kind of, you know, Tom and I have known each other, you know, since we were in college in dare I say it, 1957.
And, no, that can't be right.
That was before you were born, Mindy.
I was born, but I was only a year old.
Oh, okay. That's why we didn't date you at the time. Yeah. But what was I going to say? I was going to say something.
You've known each other for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so I was going to say a little bit how we worked together. Well, Tom was the better student than I. But I'm good at sniffing things out. So I was pretty much in charge of reviewing these thousands of cartoons. And I'd get to one and I'd say, this smells like ethical choice. And then I'd send it to Tom. And he says, not only is this ethical choice, this is utilitarianism. And I say, oh, okay, yeah, that's what I meant. And that's the way it works. Another cartoonist who we like is a guy named Bacall, and he's a regular at the New Yorker. Here's one of my favorites of him. He's got a little boy standing with his teacher in front of a blackboard, and on the blackboard is written 1 + 1 = 2. And the teacher is saying, will you please tell the rest of the class the process you used to arrive at your answer?
Obviously, this is him wrestling with the question of whether mathematical equations are analytic or synthetic.
Mm. Yes.
You don't want to know.
Well, we're hoping somebody wants to know.
Yeah,
if you want to know, buy the book.
But in the book, you cover a wide range of topics from the meaning of life and morality to politics and religion to love and sex. So while compiling cartoons for the book, were you compelled to highlight certain philosophical concepts or did you let the cartoons dictate the selection process? Or was it a combination
both
of both?
Ways,
yeah,
don't
both,
you?
Yeah,
both ways, but mostly the latter. You know, it's very hard to start off with an idea and then look for a cartoon that embodies it because the cartoon may not be explicitly at all about the philosophical point. You know, it might be two dogs talking to each other about something else. So you really, in most cases, you had to go from the cartoon to the philosophy.
Yeah. But we did have an agenda. You know, we were going to be darned if we were going to let down our readers and not address this Sappho, the Greek, early Greek philosopher and one of the first woman philosophers. You know what? I'm just sort of looking at my favorite cartoons in here, and there's another one that I like, and it's a guy inside a, you know, a, what do they call it? A snow globe. You know, the kind of thing where you shake up and it looks like it's snowing. And this guy is inside it today, and he's in a broadcast booth inside the snow globe, and he's saying, snow again today. Well, this is kind of, I mean, you just look at it and you know it's philosophical because you know this guy has a limited point of view. He lives in a snow globe, for heaven's sake.
Go ahead.
And that's a big thing in philosophy, you know, that you can never get out from behind what's available to you, you know.
Right.
And so, the, you know, the guy who did this, I've forgotten the name of the artist, David Carpenter, he has a philosophical mind, whether he realizes it or not.
The first chapter, is that all there is? And that starts with a cartoon, and obviously it's a guy arriving in heaven. Look, if I have to explain the meaning of existence, then it isn't funny.
Right. Yes, this is God. This right, is God yeah. giving him the grand tour.
Very funny.
And for us, that kind of resonated with guys who were very well-known and popular when we were in school, still are, but the existentialist philosophers Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, whose point of view was that existence is basically absurd because we don't have, like, any objective essence stamped on us when we come out of the womb. We have to make it all up from scratch. And he compared it to, you know, an object like an ashtray. He said an ashtray has an objective essence that's been given before it was brought into being. It was made to hold ashes and butts. And then as Danny says, well, we could hold ashes and butts too, but for us it would be a choice.
Yeah.
So what started...
And I'm still haven't made my mind completely on that.
And what Sartre and Camus, of course, were saying was, it's a scary thing. We're thrown into existence. There's no rule book. The ashtray sort of has a rule book stamped onto it. We don't have the rule book. So we have to decide for ourselves the meaning that we're going to give to existence. And as Sartre and Camus both said, well, that's absurd. But it would also be absurd if we sprang into life as an object and just stayed that thing and died. Yeah. So, you know, it's the obvious difference is freedom, human freedom to choose our own meaning. But from a certain point of view, it is absurd.
Mm. Yeah, and what's interesting, by the way, certain characters turn up in cartoons. You know, when you look at thousands of them, you see recurring characters. God must be number one.
Absolutely.
And a psychiatrist is number two.
Number two, yeah.
And number three is some poor schlub on an island with one tree.
Right.
Yeah. And the God in this one, and God takes on different sort of persona in these cartoons. And in this cartoon, he's a real bona fide absurdist, you know? He wants life to be absurd and funny. And, you know, he's kind of like God as Samuel Beckett or something.
We're talking with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. Their new book is I Think, Therefore I Draw, Understanding Philosophy Through Cartoons. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. Their new book is I Think, Therefore I Draw, Understanding Philosophy Through Cartoons. So we think of cartoons as primarily comical, but they can also be poignant. And as we're describing here, give us an example.
Of a poignant cartoon.
Okay. I'm thinking.
We're thinking. It's the old Jack Benny joke, you know? The guy comes up and sticks a gun in his ribs and says, your money or your life?
Yeah, well, I got to think about that.
There's a pause. Goes, I'm thinking.
All right, we can come back to that one, I guess. So I'll pick out another one that I thought was really funny, and this was the chapter, Where Do I Stop and You Begin? And this is a group of penguins, and one saying, I worry constantly about identity theft. It's funny.
That is funny. Yeah, and the whole idea of identity and, you know, where does me stop and you begin always been a big topic in philosophy. But lately, I don't know, I can't remember whether this is the one philosopher we talk about in the book, but one of my favorites is a recent British philosopher named Derek Parfit. And he kept saying, you know, it's really hard to say what a self is. And then he proposes all kinds of wacky thought experiments, like two guys are in the operating room having open skull surgery, whatever that may be, and they switch brains on these guys. And then one of them dies and the other one survives. So he's got, you know, Brown's brain and Johnson's body. And then the question is, well, who is he? You know, he remembers the other guy's wife. I don't know. It just becomes very, very confusing.
What makes us us, right?
Yeah. Yes, what
makes us us.
Right? Yeah. And it does remind me of a joke. I know we use cartoons this time, but I've become a big fan of an Indian joke series, and they're called Sardar jokes. And Sardars are you know, it's a myth that they're very literal-minded. And there's a story of the Sardar who's on the train to Mumbai, and he wants to take a nap. So there's one other guy in the compartment, and he says to him, I'll give you 100 rupees if you wake me up when we come to Mumbai. And the other guy says, 100 rupees, you bet. So the Sardar goes to sleep, and the other guy thinks, geez, that's a lot of money. You know, I happen to be a barber. While he's sleeping, I'll give him a haircut. So he takes off his turban, and he gives him a crew cut, and then he says, oh, while I'm at it, I'll shave off his beard. And then they come to Mumbai, wakes him up. The Sardar goes home, and he goes to the bathroom to wash up, and he looks in the mirror, and he says, the son of a gun. He says, I gave him 100 rupees, and he woke up the wrong guy.
In the meantime, I found a poignant one.
Oh, yay.
Yay. Am I allowed to say the word B-A-S-T-A-R-D?
I think so.
Okay. Should we take a chance?
We'll take a chance.
Okay. I can't spell, so
okay,
it's
warning, warning.
Okay. It's a rat dressed in pants and a shirt, and he's talking to what seems to be his foster parents, who are human beings, a man and a woman. They've got this adopted rat, and the father is saying to the rat, I'm sorry, but the fact that your birth parents weren't married does appear to make you a rat bastard. So we fill in the backstory. Obviously, he's been insulted at school. He's been called a rat bastard. And the father is taking a very literalistic point of view, like the early Wittgenstein. Yeah. And he's saying, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, your birth parents weren't married.
So, technically.
Yeah, technically.
Little comfort there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many of the cartoons that you include in the book illustrate or comment on daily life in the 21st century, like a street full of people walking and texting, or a group of construction workers in front of a sign that says, people working, mostly of the men. Yet the philosophy behind these cartoons might be decades or even hundreds of years old, as you're mentioning with the rat. What will What will people in 2018 who might be caught up in social media or politics or news headlines take away from the book?
Well, you know, there's one particular cartoon that I find poignant, and it's oh so current, and that is the setup of the psychiatrist and the patient. And the patient is saying to the psychiatrist, I never realized how empty my life was until I started tweeting about it. And I know whereof he speaks, you know. And this has been a big problem in philosophy, people who feel a kind of emptiness in their lives, you know, that there's that, you know, the day-to-dayness of their life, the everydayness, sometimes descends on them, and they go into deep despair. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that certain humanistic philosophies have tried to address. Frankl, Tom, isn't he somebody who addressed that?
Yeah, you remember Viktor Frankl? He was a psychiatrist. He was a Holocaust survivor, actually. And he wrote a well-known book in the 50s called From Death Camp to Existentialism. And he invented a new kind of therapy when he got out of Auschwitz, which he called logotherapy, meaning therapy, meaning that he helped people to create their own meaning for their lives. You know, very much like what we were talking about with Sartre and Camus, that and therefore he was known as an existentialist psychotherapist.
Now, it feels as though our country is growing more divided politically and socially. Are there Yeah, just a little bit, right? Are there philosophers that might help us make sense of how we got here and ways for us to come together as a country?
Well, you know what pops in my mind? What's good about my understanding of philosophy is that it's very superficial. So it's helped. But there is something that Hegel said the German philosopher, and he talked about forces of history, but he was talking a very, very big picture force. And he said, you know, you have a thesis, which is a point of view, a set of principles, a way of behaving. And then that's countered by an antithesis, an antithesis. And that we're seeing right now. And in a sense, he was hopeful because he says this results in a synthesis where the two opposing things somehow synthesize into one thing. But then that becomes, in turn, a new thesis with another antithesis. So it's ongoing. So the comfort there is that history goes on and we're just at a point of particular friction. Fortunately, I'm not going to live long enough to see it work out.
I'm still thinking about your question about how would somebody looking back from years from now relate to cartoons from 2018. Mm. And particularly the one that Danny cited about tweeting, like 20 years from now, we may
Who
not
knows
remember
what
tweeting.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tweeting probably will be long gone. Will the cartoons still make sense?
Yeah.
I think some of them probably won't.
Right.
Because we looked at old New Yorker cartoons from the 1940s. And we kind of remember, you know, we were 10 in 1949, I guess. So we kind of remember a little bit. But there are cultural references that would leave most people out in the cold, I think.
Yeah, wouldn't make sense so, now, yeah.
Wouldn't make sense, yeah.
But, you know, it is amazing. It's one of the interesting things about getting older is that references, pop references, that just seem, you know, ordinary to us, normal to us, don't, you know, the next generation, including my daughter, mm-hmm. and certainly my granddaughter, they have no idea. Like the other day, somebody was playing in a store in town. I live in a small town, and they were playing that Christmas song, Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I said, you know who wrote that? Mel Torme. And the friend of mine who runs this store said, who's Mel Torme?
Oh, no. The great yeah. Mel Torme.
And he's 50.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's 50.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's true the other way around, too. How many times I go, what are they talking about when you hear young people with, like, you know, new yeah. phrases for things? And, you know, I still occasionally say groovy, and people go, what? You know.
Yeah, yeah. I love standing in the checkout aisle. And the cover of one of the tabloids will say, Alan finally divorces Michelle. You go, who the hell's Alan and who the
right.
hell's Michelle?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know who half these celebrities are anymore.
No, neither do I. Neither do I. Yeah. I saw something about some huge and looked like a lot of fun wedding in India with elephants and what have you. And I didn't know who anybody was.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
even their special celebrity guests.
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
I
don't know why they didn't invite Mel Torme for this.
I know, right? We know that humor can loosen tension or help dissipate anger, and it has the potential to backfire and make people angrier. Are there jokes or cartoons that come to mind that might help us all see the humor in how divided we've become, or is it, think, a little too touchy for people?
Maybe a little too touchy still.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. What do you think?
Yeah. I don't know. People are so sensitive right now, and at both ends of the, mm-hmm. the spectrum. I mean, I sort of get why Baby It's Cold Outside is offensive to some people. I kind of get that. But it seems to me not important.
That's because you're not a woman.
I know. No, not lately.
I think also it's you know, how people read into things, right? Because there are people who will read into that and take offense, and others who read into it and go,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I think both men and women, both sides, right?
Yes.
It's interpretation. Yes. Interpretation, right?
That's
yes.
right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and it gets back to your point, Mindy, about how concepts change and how times change and we no longer mean the same thing.
Right.
One of the lines in that song, which I didn't realize was even there, but apparently it is, she at one point says, I wonder what's in this drink.
Yes.
Well, everybody now thinks Cosby and Quaaludes.
Right, right.
Well, in 1940, she probably meant what kind of alcohol was in here.
Yes.
Right.
You know, so,
yeah.
you know, It's a whole different deal.
It sure is. Yeah. Now, on page 166 in the book, there's a cartoon with two devils, and the caption reads, "It's getting so much harder for me to tell the difference between good and evil. All I'm certain about is what's appropriate and what's inappropriate." So what about the philosophical underpinnings of this cartoon?
Isn't that cool? There was a philosopher that I loved when we were in school, G.E. Moore. His name was, I think, George Edward or something, but he hated it, so he called himself G.E., and his wife, for reasons best known to herself, called him Bill. But in any case,
that's because she was married to another guy.
In any case, G.E. Moore said, if you try to make good, the word good means something other than good, that's a fallacy. He called it the naturalistic fallacy. Because a lot of philosophers have said, well, good means, you know, whatever causes the most happiness. Or good means, you know, whatever is in keeping with divine law or something. He said, no, that isn't what good means. Because if you ask the question, you know, is divine law really good? You're not asking, is divine law really divine law? You're asking, is that good? So he says, good is irreducible. So these guys are saying, well, I don't know what to think about good and bad anymore. All I know is what's appropriate and inappropriate.
You know what that cartoon makes me think of, at least today, and that is there's a tendency now to talk about good and evil in psychological terms. Mm-hmm. In other words, not to mention any names, but they'll say a particular political figure is narcissistic and displays narcissistic tendencies. Instead of saying he's bad, you know, and I think by saying he has narcissistic tendencies or any psychoanalytic term to describe the way a public figure is, I think that lets them off the hook. I kind of miss the old, oh, he's evil. You know, there are good people and evil people. And
so are there such things as basic moral principles? You know, are there certain philosophers that can help us discern universal moral principles at a time when we might feel they're so different from one another?
Yeah, there are a lot of philosophers who thought they were doing that. Probably the most on point was, to coin a phrase, Immanuel Kant. And he said the most basic rule, most basic moral rule, is don't do anything that you wouldn't, by your own volition, make a universal rule. So that sort of rules out selfishness. You know, anything that you don't think would make it as a universal law, that cannot be the highest good.
It's awfully close to the golden rule, I must say.
Yeah, it is very close to the golden rule.
It's a little more abstract and trickier, but, you know, and there are some exceptions. But we have found, you know, when we look at moral systems of other cultures, you know, that the golden rule seems to be a constant. That's the one that people seem to come up with, you know. Do unto others as they would have them do unto you seems to be the basic maxim that civilized man has come up with.
You can find versions of the golden rule in Hindu scriptures and Buddhist scriptures and Muslim scriptures and Baha'i, you know, all manner of religions. Hmm. So it seems to be as close probably to a cultural universal as there is.
As we can get, We are talking with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, and their new book is I Think, Therefore I Draw, Understanding Philosophy Through Cartoons. We'll talk more after a quick break.
I sell all of the produce that my husband grows.
Pat Braley, apple farmer in Acushnet.
I have my stupid question list, and this week we had a woman ask us why we don't grow apples all year round like they do in supermarkets. And even her husband thought that was a stupid one.
You're listening to WCAI, local public radio for the Cape, Coast, and Islands.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. Their new book is I Think, Therefore I Draw, Understanding Philosophy Through Cartoons. On page 182 of the book, it shows a UFO with two aliens, and the caption reads, "Hold that thought. I have to take a number five." And at first glance, it appears to be kind of a juvenile cartoon, right? Right? But
our favorite. Yeah,
but you read it as a commentary on empathy. So explain.
Yes. Well, there's a philosopher named Husserl who's famous for being a so-called phenomenologist, meaning that his way of doing philosophy was what he called feeling into. You know, it was a sort of intuitive method. And so he said that, you know, we can't always understand exactly objectively what another person means, but we can kind of feel into it. And so we do sort of an analysis of this cartoon, and we say, well, these guys aren't human beings. They look like they're Martians or from some other planet. They're on a spaceship. But, you know, they have some certain commonalities that we can kind of feel like what they're talking about. And so when the guy says he has to take a number five, that resonates with us. You know, our numbering system doesn't go quite that high, but we can kind of get the
idea. Kind of makes you wonder what that is, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does.
And it's one of the funny things about getting older. I think I know what he means. I sometimes have to do a number five myself.
All right. So most well-known philosophers, with few exceptions, are men, particularly in the 19th century and earlier. Why is that?
Oh, man.
I mean, you do mention a couple of women, but, you know, more men
than women. Yes, we mentioned Sappho. And, well, you know, Tom wrote a very interesting book on the trolley problem.
I was going to ask you about that next. So tell us, that's Philippa Ford. Yeah.
And there are two major 20th and 21st century philosophers who are at the root of that. It's a thought experiment. And they're both women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about it.
Well, it's interesting that Philippa Foot sort of came to the fore during the war, when a lot of the male philosophers weren't around. And so it's really just a classic case of patriarchy, I think. I think they first of all, a lot of young girls were not brought up to think that they might be philosophers or teachers of philosophy. But even if they were, or even if they came to this on their own, as Simone de Beauvoir apparently did, they were put down by the patriarchy. And so I think it was very difficult to get teaching jobs. When we were in college, I think I had one female teacher. She taught French. But all the other professors were male, you know, and I went to a school that, you know, was an all-male school, Harvard, but Radcliffe was conjoined. And I don't know, for the most part, the Radcliffe girls went to Harvard classes. So I don't think they even had much exposure to female teachers. It was just the patriarchy's plain and simple, I think.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, one way that women now exist on philosophy faculties in colleges is the addition of gender philosophy to the curriculum. That's very big right now. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of are genders constructs or physical things? You know, and that's an interesting question. And women have been attracted to the field for obvious reason, and so they're in that department. But you still rarely will see a woman, let's say, teaching logic or epistemology. I think it's just going to take time to catch up. Mm-hmm. One of the preeminent American philosophers right now is at Chicago named Nussbaum, right?
Yep.
And she's an Aristotelian and a moralist or an ethical philosopher, and she gets a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. She speaks very well. That doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, people line up to get to hear lectures because she's so fluent, and but it's going to take time, like it's taking all of academia time to give equality to women.
Yeah, Tom. So to explain the trolley problem and how it's been modified over the years.
Oh, okay. So Philippa Foot originally came up with this idea. What she was trying to say was that there are limits to what philosophers call utilitarianism. That is, making decisions on what is in the best interest of the greatest number, what causes the greatest happiness for the greatest number. 19th century guy Jeremy Bentham said this. So anyway, she posed this question. She said, okay, suppose you're standing by a trolley track, and as you look down the track, you see that the trolley is wildly out of control and can't stop. And when you look down the other way, beyond where you are, you see there are five people standing on the track. There's a wall on either side of them. There's no way they can get off the track. And you think, my God, what can I do? So then you notice that there's a switch, and you're standing beside the switch, and you see the switch will divert the trolley onto a sidetrack. Unfortunately, there's one person standing on the sidetrack. So the question is, do you pull the switch? Is it better to kill one person than five? Or should you say, this is out of my, you know, realm of responsibility here. You know, this is playing God. I should just let happen whatever is going to happen. So that's the big question. And so, and interestingly, a couple psychologists picked up on this and put it on the web and asked, it's called the moral sense test. It's still there. And so if you Google the moral sense test, it gives you those choices, pull the switch or not. It turns out 89% of people say yes, pull the switch. And if you ask them why, they give the utilitarian answer, which is greatest happiness for the greatest number, you know, better one than five. So then this other woman philosopher, whose name I'm blocking at the moment, but it'll come to me 5 minutes later and I'll blurt it out in a totally inappropriate context. But anyway, she's a professor, still is, I think, at MIT. And she said, okay, try this one. Now you're standing on a footbridge that goes over the trolley track. Same scenario. You see the trolley coming towards you. It's out of control. You look behind you and you see the five people are standing on the track. And there's no, and there's a wall on either side of them. And you say, oh my God. And there is no switch. There is no sidetrack. It's just a straight track. And you think, is there anything I can do? And you think, yeah, if I threw a heavy enough object in front of the trolley, I could stop the trolley. I'm standing on this footbridge. If I can just find something heavy. So he looks all around. He doesn't see anything heavy or light. There's nothing on this footbridge except for the fact that he's standing next to a very fat man.
400-pounder.
A 400-pound man. It's in, I guess it's not PC to say fat. He was heavy set or something like that. Anyway, in the example, she calls him fat. So
he was enough to stop a train.
Right.
He was big enough to stop a train. That's right. I guess we can call him fat. Anyway, so the obvious question is, should I push this guy off the bridge?
To save five people.
Five people. Sacrifice one.
What was the percentage there?
Exactly backwards. 11% said yes, they would. 89% said no way.
Mm-hmm.
And when you asked them what the difference was, they had different answers. Most people said, I don't know. This goes back to intuitionism again. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just feels different.
Hmm.
But some people said it's the laying on of hands, you know, before, right. You know, you were just allowing the trolley to hit the one person. You weren't pushing it into the one person. This time, you're actually throwing the guy. Some people say, well, what difference does that make? It's, you know, you're still killing a guy. So anyway, that's...
You know what that one reminds me of is that there was some people who said that the nuclear button that the president can push should be surgically embedded in somebody's thorax.
Right. Yeah.
And then before he can press the button, he has to slice the guy open with a knife.
Oh,
yes.
Geez.
Thinking that he would have more aversion to killing one person than to wiping out a nation.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to mention one more cartoon here, which is on page 138. This is in your chapter called Power Up. And this is a guy sitting behind a desk and another guy in front of him. And the guy behind the desk says, I don't have to be a team player, Crawford. I'm the team owner.
Yes. Yes. That's Leo Cullum, I think, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
He's one of our favorites. Yeah. Yeah, there have been a lot of philosophers that wrote about power. Friedrich Nietzsche had a whole thing about power. It sort of got perverted by the Nazis who tried to make him a Nazi 100 years after his death, but he wasn't. He was just he was being realistic that that what makes the world go round is power, and that some people he thought were destined to lead. But I think the more interesting guy these days is a guy who's again whose name I am blocking.
On what subject is he?
Power.
Let me know what
it is. Foucault. Foucault. Thank you.
There
Foucault.
You got it. Okay.
And what he said is that power really determines almost everything about a culture. He said it determines the way you think about things. He said, you know, in medieval times, if somebody was what we would now call mentally ill, they didn't call it mentally ill. They said that he had some kind of demonic possession. And the people who got to treat him were not doctors, they were the priests. Mm-hmm. And so because they were the powerful group, they got to shape what the power relationship in society was. And it was only, you know, later after the Scientific Revolution and doctors, you know, became more prominent and so forth, that they said, no, we'll decide. We'll decide what this guy's problem is, and we'll decide, you know, what we're going to do with him. You know, we're not going to, you know, listen to him for spiritual insight. We're going to put him in a mental hospital or whatever.
So what are you hoping people walk away with this book? Are you trying to get people to, like, is it that whole back to thought-provoking? What is it you're hoping?
Yes, I think that, Mindy, that I think above all, you know, thought-provoking and entertaining. I mean, that's kind of what we like to do both, and we think it's possible to do both, to be entertaining, but to not just to have a laugh at a cartoon, but to think after laughing, isn't that interesting? I never thought of it that way. Wow, somebody else thought of it in this way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a modest goal, but it's ours.
Yeah. Actually, I was kind of surprised when Plato and the Platypus came out. I thought people would say, oh, funny jokes. And a lot of people did say, oh, funny jokes. But what I wasn't ready for was how many people said, oh, this is an interesting introduction to philosophy. I think I want to read some more philosophy.
Yeah. My sense is, particularly after this book, is that just as in the golden age of Greece, everybody's a philosopher. You know, in the streets of Athens, around the Plaka in the old days, people talked ideas. Mm-hmm. They talked when they went to the theater. They talked ideas afterwards, and I think it's anybody who thinks tends towards philosophical thoughts and questions, and it's what they talk about in cafes, And then it's kind of fun to learn that some people have given a lot of thought to this and maybe have some angle on it that you haven't thought of yourself. But the idea that people, philosophy is some specialized field that only certain kind of student can approach, I don't think that has to be so. I think we all wonder about the meaning of life and is there an afterlife? And what does it mean to believe in God and what's right and wrong? I think that's stuff that we think about every day.
Hmm. So what's next for you two? Are you working on another book? Or are you planning? Is that something you've thought about? What are you doing?
We have thought about it. Yeah, we haven't really come up with an idea that has really, enthused us yet. We may yet. We didn't think we would come up with an idea this time, and we did. Yeah. So who knows? I'm thinking about a solo book. On a subject that's interested me for many years. And the working title is Jesus for Atheists. I know it is kind of funny, but it wouldn't be a funny book.
No, well.
It would be a book about, in a day when sort of the old religious language is kind of disappearing. The point you were making earlier, as times change, do the questions still remain the same? And they don't remain the same. And dogma doesn't do it for most people, or a lot of people anymore. It does for some, I guess. But so, what does that leave? Does that leave anything, or is it all gone?
All right. So we'll stay tuned for that. I think Therefore I Draw is a funny exploration of philosophy through cartoons. We'll have more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, thanks so much for joining us. Always have fun visiting with you guys. Thanks.
Thank you so
much. You are a joy. Thank you.
Also, thanks to Robert Chacon at WAMC for production assistance. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.